Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Well, hi again, everyone. I'm 1010 Wins Sports Director Mark Renee. This is On the Mark. We check into the stories behind the stories in the world of sports. Our guest today, as we take a little peek into the book nook, is Katrina Adams. She has been a professional tennis player. She made history as the first ever African-American chair and USTA president, also the first ever two-term head of that sports American governing body. She's been involved in overseeing international tennis, currently heads up a very notable junior tennis and education program up in Harlem. In addition, a global speaker, a broadcaster, she has analyzed matches for multiple outlets, including the Tennis Channel, U.S. Open Radio, the World Feed, and is also a co-host of CBS Sports Network's very popular We Need to Talk, which I only just this morning realized is coming up on 7 years old. And now she's an author. The book is called Own the Arena, Getting Ahead, Making a Difference, and Succeeding as the Only One. It's published by HarperCollins. It's available wherever you can find books. And we welcome Kat Adams to On the Mark. So nice to see you. So nice to have you on. How are you?
I'm great, Mark. Thanks for having me.
That was such a flowery introduction. We only have about 3 minutes left now.
That was extensive. I will say that.
But, so this is your, well, I wanted to make sure I covered everything, not to make it a Wikipedia entry or anything. But so now you're an author in addition to everything you've done and are doing. So my first question really is why the book? And why now?
Yeah, you know, actually this book was supposed to come out in July of 2020, but it was delayed by the publisher due to the COVID pandemic. They weren't selling books because all the bookstores were closed, everything was closed. And so they had a warehouse full of books that they couldn't move, and they delayed me until now. But it's a book that I really had no intention of writing. People were urging me and nudging me to write a book probably the last 5 years, as they felt that I had a story to share and that was interesting and that, you know, really could inspire others. And everything I do is about making a difference and bringing back and paying it forward. And once I decided to say yes, this was the direction that the book was going in. I had the faith of a literary agent that took me under her wing and the confidence of HarperCollins Publishing, the Amistad Books imprint, to actually publish it. And here we are. So hopefully it's a book that is easy to read, but that anyone who's reading it can find themselves in it in some way.
I will attest it is a terrific read. Not surprisingly, many tennis references throughout, including on several chapter names, quotations from several renowned tennis players. And I have to right off the bat thank you for teaching me, I can't believe I didn't know this, the origin of the word tennis. I studied that language though for the better part of 9 years and it never came up.
Well, that, you know, I had to do a little research on that one, but yeah, it's important, I think, it really explains the sport, it explains me, and explains everything that I've done within this arena.
So chapter one begins, Serena, Naomi, 2018 U.S. Open final. And I got the sense, please correct me if I'm wrong, that you were approaching the reliving of that episode almost like ripping off a Band-Aid, just to get it over with. Because you couldn't duck it.
It's something that has followed me since that moment. But I also thought it was something that, one, was riveting, compelling, and it was an opportunity for me to really kind of give some background information on that event. As I said, this was written in 2019, so it was fairly fresh when I started to write this. And of course, a couple years later, I didn't know how it was going to play off. But then, you know, every time they play, they bring up that moment, and they just played a couple weeks ago in Australia at the Australian Open. So it's always fresh. But it was important for me to tell my point of view, you know, and to let people know what happened, what was said, why it was said, and the intent behind it, because my words, my comments were misconstrued, taken out of context. And it's okay, because when I do listen back, I can see why people felt one way or another. And so I thought it was important to get it out there.
Given that at the time of last year's U.S. Open, you were one of the past presidents of the USTA, how relieved were you when the Novak Djokovic situation occurred that you did not have to deal directly with that?
Yeah, there was a lot of things that happened last year regarding the U.S. Open that I was relieved that I didn't have to deal with it. And that was first starting with getting the tournament on. The work that went into it and the hours that were consumed by everybody involved just to get it going. And then you have the incident with Novak. And I was actually calling another match and happened to look down. I'm in the skyboxes of Arthur Ashe Stadium, calling another match on the monitor, and I kind of looked down to see what's going on, and not having not seen it. And then when I saw the replay, I was like, oh, I'm so glad it's not me. Because that's just not a place. It's not a place that you want to be, particularly as a past player, because you have relationships with all of these players.
Right.
And so Pat knows Novak very well. And so it definitely wasn't a position that he wanted to be in. But the rules are the rules. And this was something that was black and white. It wasn't something that, had room for error or, for movement to kind of dismiss. So
I thought it was interesting because that conversation came up again about the rules being the rules. And a lot of people were immediately transported back to the women's final 2 years earlier. And I was struck by the, the similarity to a degree of the situation. I wanted to ask, because there are so many parallels that you draw between the tennis world and the business world. When did you know that you wanted to be involved in the administrative side of tennis?
When I joined the WTA Tour in 1988, I immediately got involved on the business side by joining the Players Association's board. And so I wanted to learn more about the sport. I wanted to learn more about how it operated. I wanted to learn more about our rights as players. And so being on that WTA Players Association board for a few years, and then we merged the players and the business side to the WTA Tour as to what it is today. I then got to sit on that board, which had all the business people from the tournaments and from the ITF and et cetera. So I was always intrigued by it, but I really didn't know that I wanted to go into the business side of it. And the USTA is structured very differently of how I got on the board in 2005. You apply, you do interviews, and I was nominated to the board as an elite athlete. We are a national governing body of the USOPC. And so you have to have a certain percentage of elite athletes that are within 10 years of retirement from their sport. I retired in 99 and joined the board in 05. And so when my tenure expired in 09 and it was time to re-up for the board, then I had to go in with the pool of everyone else in the nation. All these smart business people who were volunteers that wanted to give back to the sport and be a part of it. And I didn't know if I would be able to get to that level. And once I was nominated, and I felt that my words, you know, that I had value, added value in the room and respected in the room, then I was like, So I started to look at it from a different lens and started to develop that from that moment.
So what was it like? Because we can imagine perhaps life as a USTA president and chairman, but very few of us can imagine life as the first African-American USTA chair and president. So what was that all like for you?
Well, you know, I like to go into anything as I'm here to succeed and to do a job, et cetera. But I did know, I knew the enormity of that moment and how huge it was and what it represented. Prior to me even becoming an officer, we only had one person, a Black person that was an officer of the USTA, and that was Dwight Mosley way back in the early 90s when I was still on tour. And so just when I became a vice president, I knew that that added levity and weight. So when I became the chairman, I knew that I not only represented myself and the organization, but I represented an entire culture of people who were rooting for me. Because my thing is, you know, Billie Jean King always says, if you can see it, you know, you can believe it. And now here I am, that face of the organization, to where a lot of other people can now see it to believe that they can also be in that position, whether it's in the USTA or any business that had never had a person of color, a Black woman at the head of that organization. And so it meant a lot to me.
I've had the good fortune of being joined by Billie Jean now twice. I think she was the first two-time guest of this show. And I was so happy to see her at the Garden over the weekend for the debut of the Professional Women's Hockey League. She is, I think, the epitome of walk the walk.
Oh, my goodness. I mean, every day she is about, you know, it's really about equality and about being respected, no matter what she's representing. And she doesn't commit to do anything that she doesn't truly believe in. And she won't say anything that are not her words or that's not in her heart. And, you know, she's a woman that has always done her research on everything. One of the most knowledgeable women that I know across all platforms. And what she represents and what she's accomplished, you know, is we all, you know, pay homage to the great Billie Jean King.
Well, you are no slouch in the accomplishment department, Kat Adams. You oversaw, as you called it in the book, the complete rebuild of the Billie Jean King National Tennis Center out in Queens, which included the installation of the roof over Arthur Ashe, the new Louis Armstrong Stadium, the new grandstand, and everything else that goes around that goes on that campus, and the national campus itself down in Orlando. What do you consider over the course of your two-year terms, which was a first as the chairman and president of the USTA, your biggest accomplishment?
Well, the biggest accomplishment was just getting there. But, you know, all the things that happened under my tenure, you know, I have to applaud my board of directors, both boards that I oversaw and that I led, because, you know, collectively we make these decisions as to how we move forward and what we do within the organization. And then you have to applaud the staff, because the staff is really the people from all these different areas that are carrying out their task and making things happen. So when you look at the USTA Billie Jean King National Tennis Center, Danny Zausner is the chief executive out there. And so all of this really falls underneath him. I was there to support and provide oversight where needed. Gordon Smith, who was our COO, executive director at the time, also was in there day to day, you know, making sure that everything was occurring. And so I always say it's a teamwork. It's not just one person. And these were things that have been in place for years that fell under my overview. And so I was thrilled to be a part of it. I learned a lot in the process too, because I had nothing you know, no knowledge about construction whatsoever. But we also had a gentleman, Andy Andrews, who was a developer down in North Carolina, who was my first vice president, who was there every step of the way in making sure that both these projects were also done properly.
The place is phenomenal, by the way. And I've been going there since it opened back in the late 70s. And to look at it now and remember how it was when it first opened, it is night and day, to say the least. But it's been, since I was a teenager, my favorite 2 weeks of the year. And the fact that I get to work there on a regular basis every year, it remains my favorite 2 weeks of the year for a much different reason. But the joy and the gratitude that we had, I think all of us, that we were able to get the tournament in last year, especially given the circumstances and the hoops that everybody had to go through, really was remarkable. If I were to ask you your worst regret in the 4 years, would it be the German anthem incident at the Fed Cup?
That was an experience. I'm telling you, I'm standing on the court and, you know, the anthem's going on and I see the reaction of the players and I'm standing next to the German Tennis Federation president and the ITF rep, and they're speaking under their breath in German. And I'm like, okay, something's wrong, but I'm not sure what's wrong because unfortunately I don't speak German.
Right.
And so, you know, I immediately said, I said, what's happening? He goes, oh no, it's okay. It's okay. And I said, no, I said, something's wrong. And so so when it was over, he says, oh, they just, you know, they played a much older version of our national anthem. And I said, an older version. And he said, yeah. And I'm my brain is churning. And he said, pre-1994. And I just became flush of embarrassment. And it was something, yes, I would, if I look back, I wish it didn't happen, but it, you know, you learn from your lessons and you realize that you really can't cut corners in anything. And, our team, you know, our team rectified it. Our team, referring to our staff, our team of players were also embarrassed once they learned, but they didn't know what was happening in that moment. It was after the match. But I felt bad for the German players,
right,
because they were furious and understandably so, to where they really couldn't focus, you know, going out there to do what they were there to do and play their best tennis.
All right. Getting back to a much happier note, how would you want those two terms that you served to be remembered?
You know, I gave my all, you know, put my best foot forward every single day. I spent a lot of hours every day in representing the USTA. We accomplished a lot. I think we transformed the organization to a degree, into a better direction. And, you know, and hopefully the seeds that I planted are starting to bloom and hopefully, you know, grow and mature to be, you know, to reap the rewards for whatever those seeds were.
And I want to get back into the book. And again, I promise I won't give away much of the good stuff, but can we please talk about how you were responsible for pretty much giving rise to an actual fashion police squad at Wimbledon?
You mean at the U.S. Open?
I thought it was Wimbledon. Yeah, with
the
undergarments. While you were playing.
Yeah. So, you know, Wimbledon has a policy, all white attire on the court, of which every player, you know, you have to do it. But this particular day, my underpants, my tennis panties, were multicolored. And so I'm not even thinking about, you know, my tennis panties on this, you know, not being a part of, or being a part of my attire. But it was a blustery day in England. And at the time, the material of my skirt was very lightweight. So it constantly blew up. And I was on the front courts just below, outside of center court, you know, just below the royal balcony. And anyways, I was summoned into media following the match. And I'm like, why? That wasn't a big match. I'm like, what's the deal? And so they were questioning my choice of underpants. And I was like, what? What are you talking about? The next day, you know, every newspaper in England is like a tabloid, right?
Right.
So every paper, I was like on the back cover with my hiney, you know, on the back cover with the skirt up with the colorful pants. It was comical. I actually have a copy of that to this day. I went into the locker room the very next day and the locker room attendants had it taped on the wall and I was so embarrassed, and it was a fun time.
That was interesting, because I think a lot of people who can remember that era of Wimbledon remember Robin White and her bodysuit.
Anne White,
I'm sorry.
Yeah. Yep. Anne White and her bodysuit, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was the first fashion. That was the first bodysuit that was worn in our sport.
Right. And then there would be more down the road. And of course, Serena has gone the cat suit route. I want to talk to you about her in just a little bit. I was also fascinated by your mention of the handshake challenge. And it got me thinking, obviously, over the course of the last year, next week will be a full year since the sports world had shut down, that we're all missing this human contact over the course of the pandemic. And I'm wondering, what do you think the odds are that this handshake challenge might finally take hold when things get back to whatever we think will be, in air quotes, normal?
Yeah, I mean, you know, listen, the racket tap has taken the place of the handshake, and it's the same gesture. It's acknowledging one another at the end of the match. And, you know, when you think about it, when you first meet someone and you go, what do? You shake hands, right? When you go into the boxing ring before they start their battle, they tap their gloves, which is in essence like a handshake. So we stand at the net with each other before the match for the coin toss. There's no harm in tapping the rackets now to say, hey, have a good match. Or, you know, you basically know everybody. Beginning of the year, you may start to meet new players, as we saw emerge here in Australia. But I just think it's a good gesture and sportsmanship to do that. So even from our kids, teaching them that, you know, we're going into battle, but at the end of the day, when we walk off the court, you know, that battle is left on the court. So, hey, let's have a great match. And even if you don't say anything, or sometimes you're playing someone for the first time, you're introducing yourselves at that point, you know, hey, I'm Kat. Hey, I'm Mark. And whatever it is, but I think it's just something that our sport has gotten so competitive, particularly on the junior level, that the sportsmanship has really gone out the door, because for them, it's all about winning, and it's not about developing, and it's not about enjoying the battle.
So how can we reel that back in?
I would love to be able to, you know, for the tours to, you know, I think the kids do whatever they see their idols do.
Right.
So if the ATP and the WTA tours collectively can say, hey guys, let's start to tap rackets at the beginning of the match as well as the end. I don't see anybody today, based on what we've gone through in the last year, saying, no, there's no way I'm going to do that. Because everyone has realized that there are more important things than tennis. And so to just tap that racket at the beginning of the match, and then at the end of the match, what are your kids going to do? The kids are going to go out and start tapping rackets. And you know, I used to mimic John McEnroe a lot when I was growing up, you know, from the service motion, you know, we go out and I was a serving volleyer. So, you know, I, you know, come in and shove the shot and the, you know, the half volleys and whatever, and tugging the shirt and going through the service motion. But I also had a bad temper, and you know, they used to call me Jane McEnroe because I had such a bad temper. And I don't think it was because I was trying to emulate him. It's just the nickname that I got. But just think about it. So if I'm doing that for someone like that, then if I start to see these cats as a kid, you know, tapping rackets, doing the same thing.
I used to have a graveyard of broken tennis rackets that I kept in my trunk to remind me that I shouldn't break rackets and be like John. It's funny that all of his histrionics have sort of have really never faded from the memory banks. And I know you mentioned the you cannot be serious comment that he made, which gets played pretty much every year when Wimbledon rolls around. One of my other favorite passages from your book, talking about tennis, the early days of your doubles partnership with Zena Garrison, who I had the good fortune to work with at the Open last year a little bit. And the great nugget about her, as I was reading this, I'm thinking Pepe Le Pew. And it's exactly what you mentioned. She was being, for lack of a better term, romantically pursued by a fairly famous musician. And you liken that to Pepe Le Pew going after the cat, no pun intended, on your name, who was, if you remember, in one of the episodes of the cartoon, was mistakenly painted, a black cat painted with a white line down her back to look like a skunk.
Yeah, yeah. No, I thought it was a great analogy. we had some fun times. That was just one of them that I thought, it kind of lightened the mood of the book and get people to reflect in a different way. But it was a very interesting scenario. And I just remember she ran like a bat out of hell, getting off the court and ducking through the underground of the stadium. And those were fun times.
And you ran interference for her like a good teammate should.
Always had her back, so.
Final chapter, you mentioned internships. There was a fairly decent-sized brouhaha on social media this week. I don't know if you caught it, about unpaid internships. And a reporter for NFL Network, for the uninitiated, had put out on Twitter that she knew of an internship, a very short-term situation, but it was unpaid, and she was essentially vilified for trying to solicit free labor. So I'm wondering, given that you had several internships over the course of your non-tennis career, what advice would Katrina Adams give to an up-and-comer who wants a foot in the door, be it broadcasting or a boardroom?
Yeah, I think that the most important thing is, if you're passionate about something and it's a field that you want to go in, you need to get the experience. And I don't want to call it free labor. I come from a generation where when you got an internship, it wasn't paid. And you did the work, you learned a lot, you created mentors and sponsors within those organizations, because that's an experience that you can't get back if you don't have. Or you can't get if you don't have that type of opportunity to be an intern. And yes, there's a lot of paid internships, but you really need to understand what your destiny is, what is it that you wanna do, what you wanna accomplish, and be willing to put the hard work in, because it doesn't happen overnight. And if you are just, I feel that this generation wants to go from A to Z in a week. And, yes, they have a lot more information at their fingertips. They're able to learn a lot quicker than we were back in our day, or than we did back in our day. But it's still a process of developing, just like a tennis player. You have to develop. It's not about winning. It's about developing your game for the long term so that you can win. Winning in your early years does not mean you're going to win in the latter years if you don't develop every aspect of your game. So it's also the same thing in business. You're not going to win long term if you're only focusing on winning now. And you have to take the bumps and the bruises that come with it. So that's my advice.
Now, you grew up in Chicago. You wound up going to Northwestern, playing on the tennis team at Northwestern. But I know you mentioned in the book that USC and UCLA were your top choices. I'm wondering, how do you think your life would have been different had you gone out west to play tennis instead of staying closer to home?
That's a very good question, Mark. I'm the type of person that says I look back and I have no regrets because everything that I did got me to where I am today. So had I gone West or any other school, I might not have gone on the same track. You know, Northwestern was a top 10 school when I went there, as was SC and UCLA. They were also in the top 10. But I came in and played number one at NU. Probably wouldn't have gone in and played number one at SC or UCLA at that time. I'm not sure. I would have had to play my way on. And, you know, I didn't know if the coach would have let a freshman come in, even if I had won the matches, right, to do that. So my opportunities were what they were. I don't look back and regret it. But I, you know, I just thought it was a great story to add in there for a number of different, a number of reasons. And, you know, thank God I'm a Wildcat.
Would you talk to me a little bit for the benefit of our New York City audience about your endeavors up at the facility in Harlem?
Yeah, so I'm the executive director of the Harlem Junior Tennis and Education Program. We are an NJTL chapter, National Junior Tennis and Learning Network. There are a few hundred chapters around the country. NJTL was co-founded by Arthur Ashe, Charlie Passerell, and Sheridan Snyder back in 1969. And so we focus on getting kids on the court, providing them academic opportunities and wellness initiatives where or components. So we, you know, yeah, we'd love to develop the next Serena Williams, but we're more successful in making sure that that kid graduates from high school and then gets into college. And whether it's on a tennis scholarship or on an academic scholarship, or just being able to put tennis on their CV so that they have an opportunity to get into college. And I've been there 15 years. We will be celebrating our 50th anniversary next year in 2022. And we're a nonprofit organization who raises money to provide low cost opportunities for our kids. So, you know, we apply for grants. We ask for individual donations and have fundraisers to attain that.
And Kat, how did the pandemic affect what goes on there on a day-to-day basis?
Yeah, no, we were shut down for quite some time. We operate out of the Army on 143rd Street, and our landlord is the Harlem Children's Zone, which, as you know, operates a couple of schools there in Harlem, right, and other exterior programs. So we were out of our facility until literally a week ago. We had to rent courts at another facility just to get our kids back on the court. And our staff back at work. And, you know, it cost us, but, you know, we weren't getting the donations that we would have liked. We couldn't have our annual gala, which is 40% of our budget. So we struggled and continue to struggle to just get back on our feet, but we're thrilled to be back at home. We're thrilled to see the kids on the court. We are working at half capacity, a little less than half capacity because of the COVID protocols. And so it's challenging, but at the end of the day, seeing the excitement of the kids, the development, their growth, you know, getting them back active, first of all,
yeah,
getting exercise, it's helping them and it's definitely helping their parents.
Yeah, I bet. For the sake of those who might want to get involved, whether it's to volunteer when the opportunity arises, and hopefully that won't be too far down the road, or to help out financially, which at this point might be of greater importance, how can folks reach out and do exactly that?
Thanks for asking. You can go to our website, www.hjtep.org. That stands for Harlem Junior Tennis and Education Program. You know, click on the Make a Donation button and make a donation. Every dollar counts. It's not that you have to make an enormous donation. We love those that want to contribute a lot, but you know, we're really serving our youth, serving our community, and providing a safe place for our kids to grow and develop.
All right. And as we wrap up, I do appreciate all of the time today. What can we do Madam Past President of the USTA, to get more people not only to play tennis, but to pay attention to tennis on TV and radio and, you know, and get to the tournaments, not just the U.S. Open and the Grand Slam events, but, you know, some of the other smaller events that we have. And we have several in the area, at least under normal circumstances.
Yeah, well, I will say the flip side of the pandemic last year allowed, you know, the good side of the pandemic is that a lot of people started playing tennis again. They either picked up a racket for the first time or picked up the racket that they hadn't, you know, touched in many years, started going back to the public parks and to their community courts because it's a safe sport to play. It automatically provides distance between each other. You only have 2-4 players max on a court. And so, you know, it was the first sport that the governor here in New York said, hey, tennis can start to play again. Let's put those nets back up. Let's get everybody back out there. And so that started a boom that we hadn't seen and a growth that we hadn't seen in many, many years, which is exciting. But the important thing is that those people who have gotten back in the sport or have gotten in the sport for the first time have programs that they can go to, whether they continue to be in their park and recreation facilities, whether they're in tennis clubs, et cetera. You know, we want to make sure that you understand the healthy benefits of the sport. It is a sport for a lifetime, whether you're, you know, 6 or 106, okay, maybe 96. But you can get out there and play and make sure that you are, you know, still being socially distanced where necessary. And, you know, look in you can go to USTA.com to find out for local pro circuit events that may be coming to your area. These are the early stages of professional tennis. It's the level that I started in. And there are a lot of small market towns and cities. Go out and watch. And, you know, and you never know if you're going to be watching the next Serena Williams or the next Novak Djokovic. And, you know, these kids these players are great. You know, you look at Jen Brady, who got to the finals of the Australian Open, played at UCLA. You know, she started on the pro circuit series like everybody else to develop the ranking. So please support them. I know we've had the New York Open here out at Nassau Coliseum in February. I'm not sure if it's happening this year, but there are smaller events in the New York area outside of the U.S. Open.
Yeah, we've had some tournaments in the Bronx over the years. The Long Island Open was a preview, if you will, or a warm-up tournament for the U.S. Open. We had the tournament in New Haven for several years. There was one in Mahwah, New Jersey. I don't know if you ever played in that one. But
played that one with John Corf, yeah.
That was a lot of fun up there on Route 17 at the Crossroads. We opened with Serena and Naomi. I think it's a good place for us to start to wrap up because they met, as you mentioned, in the semifinals in Melbourne, and Serena came up short again. So it's now, you know, 4 calendar years since she won her last major, and she's still one away from the all-time singles major title record. Do you think she gets there? Let's put your broadcaster cap back on.
Yeah, I mean, it's getting tougher and tougher because each day she's getting older and older. But I will say that, you know, the Serena Williams that we saw in Melbourne a few weeks ago was the best Serena Williams that we've seen in 4 years since she won the Australian Open in 20, what was it, 17?
17, yeah.
17. So, you know, you can never count her out in the draw. And I think it's a situation of her continuing to play at her best and perhaps the draw starting to open up with some of these big players like Osaka getting knocked out before they have to that she would have to play them. But, you know, when I was watching the matches here in the middle of the night last month, you know, she played 3 matches in a row that could have easily been a final with Sabalenka from Belarus, Simona Halep, who she destroyed in the quarters, and then of course came up against a very in-form Osaka, and Serena did not play nearly the caliber of tennis that she had played in those previous matches leading up to that. So, you know, she can bring her best against in Osaka. You know, I'd love to see that match where they're both at their best, but Naomi is just a remarkable player and reminds me a lot of Serena when Serena was her age, a better version of Serena actually when Serena was her age. And so I hope she can get it, but you know, it takes a lot of, not only just the physical drain from Serena, but the mental drain of trying to keep it together and knowing that it's, you know, she can reach out and touch it, but yet hasn't been able to achieve it.
Yeah. Now people have asked me, and I simply refer them to the math. They ask if Naomi at 4, and she's 4-for-4 in major finals, can catch Serena, let alone Margaret Court. And again, I just refer to the math. You know, 4 is a long way from 23, and we're seeing how far 23 is from 24. Do you think there's anyone out there right now who can catch Serena?
Well, I would say at this point it would be Naomi. If Naomi, does, you know, doing the math, I mean, look, Serena 2 years in a row won 4 in a row, but just in different calendar years. She had 2 Serena slams.
Right.
So Naomi is that player right now that can do that. I mean, she's playing with that much confidence, but she has the game to do it. So it's a matter of her staying healthy. Just think of all the years that Serena didn't play. You know, she was out with injury, or, you know, she lost her sister 1 year. And, you know, just think if she did play in those years in some of those tournaments, she probably would be at 30 by now. But I think if there's one player that can do it, it would be Osaka.
And on the men's side, somebody brought up a stat the other day. I can't even remember now how many years it's been running, but the top 2 players in the rankings have either been Federer, Nadal, Djokovic, or Murray for, I think it's going on 12 or 13 years.
It's a lot.
And maybe more. Can you fathom how that's possible?
Well, I think it's remarkable because I go back, you know, the generation before them when we had, you know, Pete and Courier and Agassi and Chang, who happened to all be American, who were at the top of the game at that time. And, you know, when Pete surpassed Roy Emerson, you were like, oh, wow, that'll never happen again. And we're 7 Grand Slams beyond that, or 6 Grand Slams beyond that with Roger. So it'll be a generation and another in a different life, I think, lifetime. I don't think I'll be around to see that kind of dominance in the men's sport again, if that happens. There are a lot of great players that are coming up. When you look at Medvedev and Rublev in particular, and Tsitsipas, you know, you're saying, okay, these are going to be the next big 3. Put Sasha Zverev in there when he wants to decide to be consistent. You know, those are your next big 4 guys. And I'm just not sure if they're going to be trading back and forth, you know, in the next 5 years when Rafa and Roger and Andy and Novak are gone. And yeah, I don't see that happening again.
So the big 3 have 59 between them. Nole is 1 back after winning in Australia. Again, your broadcaster cap on, please. Who winds up in the end with the most majors of those 3?
It'll be Novak because he has the ability to play on all surfaces. So, I mean, he can, you know, he can win on clay, he can win on grass, he can win on hard. And, you know, Rafa, you know, with his knees, you know, just call him Mr. Roland Garros. He'll win Roland Garros again in 2021. And, but, you know, I don't see him winning Wimbledon or, you know, the U.S. You know, he didn't play it last year. And so we'll see.
It's amazing, isn't it, that they have so many between them? And I think, and I've said this for a few years now, that even though Novak has a winning record against both of those guys, he's still not in the conversation for a lot of people of that GOAT category, greatest of all time.
Yeah, it's challenging. I mean, he will, you know, I think personality has a lot to do with it. And I think when Novak came on the scene in his early years, a lot of people just didn't like his disposition on the court. You know, we felt that he had a lot of antics. He had a lot of stalling. You know, remember he had the breathing issue early on, of which he did further go and get that sinus surgery that was needed to help out. But it was just his behavior, if you will, that a lot of people just were not fond of Novak. And obviously, you know, Roger is Mr. Gentleman. And everybody loves Roger. Everyone's become to love Rafa. He's comical. He's, you know, he speaks from the heart. He's passionate. The same passion that Novak has, but I think there's just a lot of other side effects, if you will, where people didn't like early on, and it's hard for him to kind of be in that same category, you know, with those two.
It's funny, when he came on the scene, as you were alluding to, the antics included his impressions. And I think some of us, you know, I think the spectators especially got a kick out of some of them, the Maria Sharapova impression, the Rafa impression when Rafa was wearing the capris and would have them ride up a little bit. And I could see where some players and former players like yourself might not have taken too kindly to that. So I appreciate it. And yeah, I think it's, you know,
personality. I think it was a breath of fresh air to have someone come out with that type of personality, you know, in the comical sense. But there were other things in his matches that that stood out. But Listen, you cannot take away the talent that Novak Djokovic has. You cannot deny the professionalism of how he trains, how he takes care of his body, and how he approaches the sport. I respect his game immensely. I think it's incredible the way that he can move around the court, the flexibility that he has. I mean, he's amazing, and he will be that player that will, you know, probably surpass both Roger and Rafa, but Roger always my favorite.
We are wrapping up with Katrina Adams. She is, among other things, a broadcaster, an author. The book is Own the Arena, Getting Ahead, Making a Difference, and Succeeding as the Only One. It's from HarperCollins, and again, you can find it wherever you find books. Hey, Kat, as we wrap up, what do you want readers to take away from the book?
Mark, great question. You know, it's, I think everyone can find themselves in the book. You need to recognize that you own your own destiny if you allow yourself to dream big, to work hard, and take responsibility and be accountable for how you're developing yourself. And so it's a book for all ages, gender, race, ethnicity, et cetera. And, you know, hopefully you will find your yourself owning your own arena, whatever space that might be.
I appreciate the time. Thanks so much for doing this. And I can't wait to see you in Flushing. And hopefully we won't have to socially distance. We'll be able to take the tennis court together and maybe we'll get to call some matches together for a change.
That would be great. That would be great. Thanks a lot, Mark. Appreciate it.
Looking forward to it. I'm Mark Renee. That is the incredible Katrina Adams. And you're On the Mark.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. T-Mobile.com.
Protect your vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during Old Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.